Welcome to Apparently, the podcast for absolutely average parents. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Ann and I met at our first radio jobs and have been friends ever since.
We had fun in our 20s as wing women for each other.
And in our 30s, we got married.
Then we had babies within weeks of each other.
Eventually landing the hardest job we've ever had, parenthood.
Our kids are 12 and 10, but we'll talk about everything from babyhood to menopause.
We want to discuss topics that interest us and you and bring some knowledge to other average parents. We make it look easy. We
make it look good. Yeah, we're average, not experts. So we'll talk about the topics with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll get the experts, and I'm sure to embarrass myself along the way.
Yeah, after the first season, I'm pretty sure we already have.
So welcome to Apparently. We make it look easy. Apparently, infertility affects more people than we know. Did you know that, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 7.3 million Americans have used infertility services?
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And I think infertility is often a misunderstood condition and one that maybe we need to talk about and discuss.
Yeah, because by talking openly and honestly, maybe we can provide couples the opportunity to share with their family and friends. We want to provide support as people struggle.
Correct. And it's even more poignant this week because it is National Infertility Week. So it's just giving a platform for us to discuss. We have two kids. You have two kids. But I have had friends who suffered from infertility, and I have seen firsthand it is a tremendous stressor and burden, both with your partner, but then in your family. And it's an uncomfortable topic, I think, and maybe by talking about it more openly, maybe it wouldn't be so squishy and uncomfortable or stressful.
Yes.
It's stressful both for the couple and for family, the surrounding loved ones and friends, because I'll be honest, I don't always know what to say or do or to comfort our loved ones about it. And it's not like I haven't cared about their situation. I just don't know how to support them properly and how to the right things to say or do.
Right. Because I think so often we say the wrong things, right?
Yeah. Or we don't say anything at all, which comes off as like callous, like we don't care. But it's really because I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to sound like a dummy. So I did not have infertility challenges, but I've had plenty of friends that did. And as we got older, you and I both had kids around the same time. It was really difficult to manage some of these relationships because as someone who didn't struggle, I felt really bad for those that did. And in a way, maybe a little bit guilty about it because I personally, when I got married, I was really excited to have kids and start a family. And, you know, not everyone gets married and has kids, but that was our goal. And we wanted to raise a family. So we didn't have that stressful start to our marriage.
Sure.
But that isn't true for everybody. And I've had friends that have to go to multiple baby showers and birthdays and baptisms. And one particular friend, it's very traumatic for them to continually go and put on that smiley face when they're just dying to have a baby.
Right, right.
So you didn't have trouble.
No, I didn't have any issues conceiving the first time. But after Sophie was born, we had a miscarriage. And I remember then being not just wanting a second child, but like being desperate to have a second child, right? Like I needed to replace, not that you can replace anything, but, and I do remember, like, so you were talking about the, you know, constant reminders, right? Everywhere I looked, I saw pregnant people, and you were one of them because you were pregnant with Ethan, and Sarah was one of them. She was pregnant, with her firstborn. Sarah's your sister. My sister was one of them. Seriously, everywhere I looked.
Right.
And I kept feeling like there was something missing from me or that it was my fault. And also, like, just for the record, when you're trying and trying and trying, it is not romantic.
No.
So that was like there was a real stress, just try, you know, like making it clinical in a way. And so Luckily, we were able to, you know, get our second one. But
did you know that I had a miscarriage?
You did?
I did before Kate.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew
that. I was in Denver.
Ah.
I did. But so there's a loss there. I mean, when you're trying, but it ultimately worked out, you know, obviously, because we're here having a parenting podcast.
But it's true. Either that or we're totally lying all the time.
Fakers.
Yeah. You know, but it's interesting, too, though, when you have a pregnancy after a miscarriage, I found that I was fearful all the time because I was waiting for another miscarriage.
Oh, okay.
So did you?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
I'm sure I did. But it ultimately was a successful birth, obviously.
Yeah.
Just turned 13.
She's a teenager.
So, but I do know that I just from talking with my one friend in particular, I didn't think about it when you want to include your friends at these joyous things, like asking them to come to the birthday party or the baptism or baby shower. But at the same time, like, you're not thinking. It's not like you shouldn't not invite them, but at the same time, I heard it out of her mouth, and it made me think, oh,
right.
Gosh, I didn't think about it like
yeah.
that. Oops. And so I thought, well, hey, let's bring in somebody to talk about it because it is an awareness week with National Infertility Week. We're bringing in Rebecca Flick. She is the Vice President of Communications and Programs for Resolve, which is the National Infertility Association, to come on and talk to us about this important week. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you both for having me.
So could you tell us a little bit about your organization, Resolve, and how it got started?
Sure. So Resolve was founded in 1974 by a woman a nurse who was experiencing her own infertility. Her name is Barbara Eck, and she founded the first support group around her kitchen table. And she saw the need for support. And to give you some context, this was before even the very first IVF baby was born in the U.S. So she was gathering women who were going through infertility around her kitchen table and started support groups. And in 2005, the organization moved from its founding state in Massachusetts to outside the Washington, D.C. area so we could focus more on policies that impact people with infertility. And we've continued to carry the mission that we were founded on for support and awareness and advocacy. And today we have close to 300 support groups nationwide.
Wow.
So face-to-face, peer-to-peer support is not dead, even though the internet would like you to think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very strong advocacy program, both with state and federal policies. And then we founded National Infertility Awareness Week in 1989.
So what's the goal of the National Infertility Awareness Week? Is it to destigmatize? Is it to gain more funds? What are you hoping to achieve?
As the organization that founded this, we create the platform for the community to take the movement public. And we believe that when there is public awareness around a disease like infertility or other family-building challenges, that you remove stigma, and when you remove stigma around something that's so complicated and people don't understand, like you were just talking about, you're also going to remove barriers. And there are a lot of barriers that people who struggle to build a family face when it comes to all of the options that there are in today's amazing medical world. But there are a lot of barriers. There's a lot of religious barriers. So we kind of use this week and every day of the year to help educate the public and reduce the stigma around infertility.
Sure. Medically speaking, what does infertility mean? Like Anne and I just talked about our own miscarriages. Mm-hmm. Is it multiple miscarriages? Is it just not even, you know, what is infertility technically speaking?
Sure. So the medical diagnosis is the inability to achieve a pregnancy, and if you're under 35, that's within 12 months of trying to conceive, and if you're over 35, their time is reduced to 6 months. Also within the definition is if you have more than two concurrent miscarriages, so that there was no live birth in between the miscarriages, that's also a form of infertility. So miscarriage is definitely part of the discussion.
Okay.
Oh, that's good to know. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about some of our friends and their experiences. But I wanted to ask you, too, about the extreme cases that we hear about. You know, even my daughters now know about Octomom. I don't know how they found that. I blame the Google. but I read 1 in 8 couples, or 12% of married women, have trouble getting pregnant or sustaining a pregnancy. Is infertility attributed to the female, or is it men too?
So, you know, we put a lot of focus on the female side of the partner because they're the ones trying to achieve the pregnancy. They're the body that's going to carry the pregnancy and then ultimately undergo the medical treatments associated with trying to get pregnant. But when you look at the diagnosis, 30% of infertility cases are female related, meaning there's a function issue with either the ovaries, fallopian tubes, uterus, egg quality, a number of things. 30% of the time, it's male driven. And then the rest of the cases are unexplained or some impact of both male and female.
So it's more
and unexplained. It is just there's no everything. All the tests have come back. Everything appears to be healthy and in working order. And yet infertility is still there.
But so it's pretty even. So it's not, you know, because I feel like women mm-hmm. feel that it's their fault more than men do.
Yes. And they're always the first line of defense, so to speak, because they're the ones that are at their OBGYN. They're the ones that are trying to get pregnant. So they're going to talk about it first. They're going to be looked at first. And then if the all clear is there, you know, on the female side, then they start looking into the male. And, you know, we kind of encourage people who are struggling to conceive that, you know, a sperm test, I will be honest, a sperm test is a lot easier to go through for the men than everything else that some women have to go through. So
amen.
Definitely bring your partner into the conversation as early as you can.
Okay. Do most couples that have infertility issues seek intervention or help? Is it possible to track that? I'm jumping the gun here a little bit, but like if you're after a year and you are unsuccessful, do most women go forward and try to look in alternatives?
I would say no. We don't have any hard data, but our years in this space and our close partnership with the medical community, we know very much that this is an underutilized medical treatment. And a lot of that has to do with access to insurance coverage. People automatically rule it out because they don't have insurance coverage for it, and there's just not something that they can afford. Also, there could be a lot of stigma with having to go through or see a specialist. And also, too, I think there's a big myth that people don't understand that just because you go and see a reproductive endocrinologist, which is a fertility specialist, it doesn't always mean IVF.
What are the options? Because I know I have a friend who she took a medicine called Clomid, and I think that mm-hmm. helps release eggs. I have another friend who tried 3 times with an IUI, and I don't know what that means. And then she moved on to IVF. So can you explain, let's pretend, so Tracy and I are older than 35. So let's pretend it's been 6 months and I have not conceived. What are the options in a typical way that I could take?
So it's definitely going to depend on what the condition is that is causing the infertility. So there's no roadmap. A lot of people are like, oh, first you know, take the Clomid, and then if that doesn't work, you try the IUI. And IUI is intrauterine insemination, where they stimulate the ovaries and inject the sperm right to the woman. Mm-hmm. There's no process like IVF, which is you retrieve the eggs from the woman's stimulated ovaries, the male provides a sperm sample, you mix this, I'm being very basic here, but you mix
sure.
this together in a petri dish, and you hope that embryos are created out of there, and then with you and your doctor, you choose, you know, placing an embryo back into the female, and then hopefully it implants, and there's a pregnancy. So there's a variety of things. It's going to depend on your diagnosis. For example, I was not a candidate for IUI. Wasn't even an option for me. So we went straight to IVF.
Why would that happen? Was it And I don't want to be too personal, but like, I have several friends who did the IUI and they were like, I have to try this 3 times, but I know it's not going to work. Like they were pretty much sure.
It was driven by their insurance coverage, probably.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
So often insurance plans have those kind of restrictions where they're going to try something that's less,
sure,
less effective and less expensive.
Yeah.
And you have to try and fail. So could you imagine that? Like you are being told you have to, and my insurance plan did this. And when we fought it, I couldn't produce eggs. I was 30. Mm-hmm. I had the ovaries probably of, 45, 47 year old. And I couldn't even produce the eggs without major stimulation in order to go through any, the IUI. My insurance plan also said they wouldn't cover IVF until I'd had 3 miscarriages.
Oh,
so could you imagine if I could get pregnant, I would have to experience a miscarriage 3 times.
That's brutal.
My insurance coverage. Yes, it's painful. And these are the barriers that are out there for millions and millions of people. And so what our advice would be to anybody listening is that you need to look at this as a course of treatment. There is something going on. You have to find out what it is. And then you sit down with a specialist. I think there's also a comfort level that people have with their OBGYNs. If they've been there a long time and, that's what the OBGYN focuses on, especially if they've maybe delivered a baby through their OBGYN before, and this is a secondary infertility issue, there's a trust level there. But if you had a disease like diabetes, or if you found out you had cancer, you would go to a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And reproductive endocrinologists are there to help treat your infertility. And they can find out what's going on, help you understand it, and then you decide on your course of treatment.
Sure. Do states have insurance or coverage mandates to help cover the cost? Like, is some states like better than others to live in to be supported like that? I remember one friend going to Colorado. Now, I don't know why she went to Colorado. I mean, I know why she was going to a fertility specialist there, and I don't know if it was an insurance thing or if that's who she thought was the best, but that's off top. But is there like insurance, when you talk about insurance, is there a state level that it depends on where you live, what your coverage is like?
Yes. Yes. Very much so. There are only, I'm scrolling through our website right now because we have all of this information by state on there. There are different types of insurance mandates. Some mandate to cover, some mandate to offer. You have the top level of insurance mandates are in states like Illinois and Massachusetts. New York just passed through the governor's budget a phenomenal update to their insurance law that will take place in 2020. And so you really have to understand what your state laws are to see if you're covered in any way. But so often self-insured plans are opted out of these laws, and self-insured are usually large employers. So there are a couple ways that you can go about getting insurance coverage for infertility. One is if understand your state mandate and where you fall into that. Another way is to go directly to your employer and ask for it. And we have an entire toolkit on resolve.org that walks you through the steps, gives you all the information you need, gives you a letter template, gives you all the stats, talks about how important this coverage is. And we did a study about a year ago that showed that people who had insurance coverage through their employer felt valued and felt more connected to that employer than those that don't.
Absolutely.
So for any employers listening out there, it's not a huge expense. It makes a world of difference in someone's life who's going through this because they have that coverage. They have that sense of ease that there are going to be so many barriers in front of them to achieving their resolution and getting to the parenthood that they want, that taking the cost barrier away from them, it's life-changing.
Yeah, I mean, it's stressful enough when it doesn't work every month that you try, but then when you consider like the financial, like, so not only is there like your partner, your relationship with your partner is strained, but also like a financial strain because you both want it, but gosh, you can't, it's money's tight and you can't do it, You just can't afford it. You want it so bad, but it's cost prohibitive.
Yes, and Resolve never says that IVF is expensive because it's uninsured. It's uncovered. It's cost prohibitive, just like what you just said, because if you were to break down the cost of delivering your pregnancy, you would say, if it wasn't covered by insurance, you would say, oh, that was expensive, right? So we know a lot about things that are we don't know the cost of things that are covered. And the average cost of an IVF cycle in the U.S. is $12,500. If you're looking at this as a course of treatment and say you need two or three to achieve your pregnancy, you know, it's $36,000, $37,000. So I don't know many people that when they start to get pregnant say, oh, let's get that saving started. We might need $37,000 to have a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do remember when we got the bill for my firstborn and what we paid versus what, and I was hospitalized for, it was a long story, but we paid minimally compared to what the hospital charged. I mean, it was more than $100,000. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, what if we hadn't been insured?
Yeah.
Right. And you know, people that go through infertility treatments who don't have insurance coverage can sometimes make risky choices because they know that they might only have one or two shots at this. So they might be taking risks like, multiple embryos,
right,
and, you know, and putting themselves at a high-risk pregnancy or, you know, high-risk twins. I'm not at all judging anybody who makes those decisions, but I think when you're talking about it from a perspective of, you know, what can insurance coverage do for someone with infertility, it helps them and their doctor be able to make choices based on what they have available in their coverage, not what they have available in their bank account. So
right.
I think that's helpful.
I have a friend who's going through this right now, and they will only implant one egg or one embryo at a time because of that. They don't, you know, but mm-hmm. she's covered. So, they do genetic testing, and I mean, there are so many layers to it. But I can imagine, you know, putting three in or four in because you're hoping one will survive, and then what are the mm-hmm. odds that you get four, and how does that impact you?
Right, and the cost of high order multiples is far more costly on hospitals and insurance companies than covering IVF.
Sure. So as an organization, how do you help couples manage the stress? Like, you know, are there, certainly there's the medical side of treatments, but do you have advice for people who are, you know, going through this and looking at each other, you know, with stress and fear and a little bit of despair?
Yes. So that's really why we continue the support groups in communities all over the country, is because, and a lot of them are male and female support groups. So couples are going together and they can walk into a room and they can feel like everyone in this room will get me. There's no judgment, and it takes a bit of stress off the whole process. They also, when you connect with people who either have been through this or are going through it, you might look at other options that you never thought before. You know, like egg donation or using a sperm donor or, you know, receiving donated embryos, adoption. Everyone has their own kind of preconception on how they want to build their family. Nobody ever says, you know, as they're growing up, I want to go through IVF to build my family.
Right.
Some people do say, I do want to adopt, and that is an amazing process. But when you're faced with infertility and you have all of these options, you might not really truly understand all the options until you meet someone who has been, you know, has made a decision and built their family in a different way, and even leaving child free. We have support groups that have helped people understand that, you know, none of these options is going to be what's right for them, and they've found strength and empowerment and encouragement from others who live child free. And that can be very freeing to someone who's suffered so much disappointment that they take that step and they say, I'm going to choose to live child free.
And connect with people who also have made that decision, you
mm-hmm.
know, that because then you have each other to go through it. Oh, when this happened, how did you handle it or whatever?
Right. And so the face-to-face connections all across the community are so valuable. We host awareness walks. We have two types of awareness walks. We have signature walks of hope, and they happen in 8 cities around the country. And then we have people in their local communities who want to step up and help Resolve and support Resolve's mission. And they host local community DIY walks, we call them. We have 10 happening this weekend.
Wow.
This is really a way for people to create what we say, create community around a cause. And they connect with people. And then through our advocacy work, we really are empowering people to take charge of their infertility. And so we host a Hill Day on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., where people come up and they talk to members of Congress about their personal stories. We have several bills in Congress right now that will help federal employees gain access to IVF, our veterans gain access to IVF. There's a huge problem in the VA system and in our active military that when someone is injured and the injury causes their infertility and they can no longer serve our country as active duty, they're immediately transferred into the VA system. And the VA system up until last year didn't have any coverage for IVF. And that's
wow.
the only way that many of our servicemen and women can achieve parenthood. So there's a lot of issues, a lot of that affects so many different types of people in this country. And we, as an organization, that's the patient voice, bring everybody together in a multitude of ways, create community around this cause, and create change.
So you talk about support groups for the couples going through it. Does some of this advocacy support the loved ones and friends and family of the people going through it? Because I was reading on the Resolve website about etiquette. Of things, you know, how to help support your friend that's going through it. And I have to be honest, mm-hmm. I was reading some of the things not to say, and I was like, oh, crap.
Yeah, because you said them.
Yeah, because I said them. Like, relax. It's going to work. You know, relax. I said relax. That was like the number one thing that said not to say, and I said it. I know I said it. Don't ask why they're trying IVF.
Don't ask why they aren't trying IVF.
Why they aren't trying. Yeah, like try to be the doctor for them.
And oh, say, God.
Don't complain about your pregnancy. That contributes to what I was talking about earlier about being uncomfortable, like because I feel guilty that I was pregnant and maybe my friend who I know was struggling with it. It's so uncomfortable. I mean, to everyone that's going, you know, through it, you just don't know what to say. Don't push adoption.
Absolutely.
So does the support groups involve like on the website, how to help the people that are friends with the people going through it?
I think that the support groups do, you know, every support group can be a little unique based on the leader. And I know that some support groups invite others to, you know, bring your mom or bring your sister. Or, we like to say bring your fertile friend so they can learn a little bit of something. But really the support groups are for the people going through it. And we hope that they're getting tools to have the conversation open and honestly. And I know that I think people with infertility, they don't want to take anybody's joy away. So, you know, you're talking before about baby showers and birthday parties, and they don't want to take that joy away, but they're going to protect themselves and maybe start saying no and not going to those things. Because if they're open and honest and can share how they're feeling, that they don't want to be there, that'll take some joy away from you if you're the one celebrating. And I don't think anybody with infertility wants to do that. You know, you listen to your friends when they say something like, you know, if you're in a big friend group and everyone's going, you know, trying to get pregnant at the same time and you know you're the one struggling. I said to my friends, when it happens for you, can you just tell me first and then do your big announcement however you want? I needed that protection. And I had friends that honored that and I had friends that didn't. But at least I knew I was protecting myself.
Sure.
And you know, the baby shower, I didn't like baby showers. I didn't want them even when I achieved pregnancy, you know, cause I knew how they made me feel. And so I would say to friends and family who has someone going through this, you know, just listen to them, ask questions. Like you said, don't offer solutions. You're not the doctor. You're not in their shoes. But empathy goes a long way.
I was going to ask about that because I do have a friend going through this, and every time I see her, I want to say, how are you doing? But I don't want to pry. It's not wrong to say, you know, say, how are you doing? Can I help? Is it?
No, I mean, I think it's like anybody who's struggling with something. You know, if you have a friend going through cancer treatments, you know, always give them, this is how I live my life. This is not maybe Resolve advice, but I always say, may I do this for you?
Mm-hmm.
can I, you know, bring you a meal on Friday? Or can I take you to yoga?
Mm-hmm.
So, because if you're asking them what you can do for them, they're going to be paralyzed and not really feel comfortable saying what they really need. They just need you to take the first step and say, how about we go do this together? And make it something that doesn't involve your kids if you have children, or maybe not centered around, you know, where children are the focus. So like a yoga class or,
sure,
you know, go to an adult-focused restaurant or something.
Sure. Well, Mother's Day is coming up. That was another thing that was on the under etiquette, was talking about, remember that Mother's Day is painful for them. With Mother's Day, you know, around the corner, as somebody that's gone through it, what's a good thing to do, or how could we treat or respect our friends that are going through this right now on that day?
I think, you know, on that day, realize that they probably will, if, you know, they're really in the depths of things, just not leave the house, mm-hmm. and that's okay. You know, it's kind of the same thing when, if you have a close friend who maybe lost her mother recently, you know, kind of that, if they're not in the mood to celebrate, it's okay, but maybe pick a day during National Fertility Awareness Week, or mm-hmm. pick a day after Mother's Day and, you know, take her to get a pedicure, or, you know, go for a long walk, and don't talk about any of it unless they bring it up.
Rebecca, you mentioned that you achieved pregnancy. Do you have kids? Can we celebrate something?
Oh, sure. I have an 11-year-old who's about to finish elementary school and head off to middle school, which is scary.
We know.
And he got his hair dyed green this weekend. And I have a 4-year-old daughter who was the shock of our life.
Oh.
And we had in between those two, we had years of trying to pursue adoption. You mentioned that, you know, don't suggest adoption. And I can tell you, people say, oh, you should just adopt. And there is nothing just about it.
Right.
And the process is very hard, and I'm amazed at people that stay the course and finish the adoption journey. It just, my husband and I went into it, and some things happened, and we decided to stop. And then we were blessed with our daughter unexpectedly. And you know, infertility is a funny way of sneaking up on you, because when I realized I was pregnant, I was angry, and I thought, oh, have I been a fraud all these years? And my president and CEO of Resolve, she and I have worked together for 14 years now, and she said, I have watched you struggle for almost a decade. You know, there was nothing, you know, you for 10 years it took you to get pregnant one time.
Right.
So in all of those years of trying, I managed one pregnancy on my own and one pregnancy with IVF. And I was angry, and it took me a little while to get over that. But she's a joy. She is our, you know,
keeps you on your toes.
One volume and one speed. So,
well, congratulations though, because you know,
you.
We as parenting podcasters, I think we would agree that there's nothing that we love more than being moms. So, I'm happy to hear of your success.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for helping talk about it this week, with it being National Infertility Week. And your website at Resolve, it has a lot of great resources for folks, and we'll attach it to the podcast as well so that they can go and look up resources and that etiquette page, or how to support your loved ones. That was the one that I particularly enjoyed reading, because as somebody that has been successful, I do have friends that have not been so successful, and I think it's just good reading anyway to be a better person and a better friend or sister or brother.
Yep.
So Rebecca Flick, the Vice President of Communications and Programs for Resolve, thank you so much for joining us today and kind of talking through what this week is all about and how we can be supportive of our friends and family.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. So apparently, infertility affects many more people than you might think, and we need to offer support and comfort to our friends who are struggling to get pregnant.
Yeah.
This is a good week to think about it and reflect on it and check out the website. It really has some good... I mean, when I read that etiquette page, I was like, oh my God. I'm not kidding how many things I've said.
You have, and
like
you
a
have
dummy.
No, yeah, you have no idea how what you say might land. right?
Yeah. You don't know when you're not in those shoes. So it definitely gives you pause to read it and go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Better. I'm gonna say it differently next time.
Right.
So Monday morning quarterback, my conversations from like 5 years ago.
As we do quite yes. a bit. Yes. So we'd love to hear from you about this. Does infertility affect you, or what would you wish people would know about it?
What drives you crazy when you hear it from a friend, or what do you wish they knew about your struggles? If so, we'd love to hear from you if you'd share with us. You can check out our Facebook page or give us a call at 331-704-0046.
Or email us at apparentlypodcast@gmail.com. This is a WGN Plus podcast. I'm Ann Johnsokes.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Thanks for listening to Apparently. We make it look